Hi, this is Alex Nee, the CEO and founder of Divergence Neuro, and you're listening to the Neuro Noodle Network podcast.
Welcome to Neuro Noodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology podcast, featuring our neuropsychologist, Dr. Laura Jansons, Dr. Skip Rinn, and neurofeedback legend, Jake Unkelman. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we have a special guest, Alex Nee from Divergence Neuro. But before we start, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tour Talk, Alternative Behavioral Therapy, EEG and Me, Mara, Sadia M, and Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. Happy New Year, guys. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that's been around for 15 years. Tour Talk wants more people to discover text-to-speech because listening to text can increase efficiency and reduce stress. And Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy is his neurofeedback service in Vancouver, Washington. How you doing, Joshua? Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out. If they can't hear us, we can't help them. Okay, today we have Alex Nee from Divergence Neuro. This is a big Divergence Neuro month. Alex, welcome to the show. Please give us your background. How'd you get started, Mr. CEO of Divergence Neuro?
Well, thanks, Pete. It's a pleasure being here. How I got started in this is really sort of by accident. In 2015, I was recruited to be the chief technology officer of another neurotech startup by the name of Avertus. We were focusing at the time coming up with our own dry wireless EEG device. And a big part of that is having the AI-driven algorithms to help us predict epileptic seizure onset as well. So, you know, it's half software, half hardware. So it was really kind of a comprehensive tour to what neurotech really is about, you know, from an EEG perspective, right? So how I got bit by the bug. You learn so many wonderful things about what you can do with EEG, you know, it's hard to walk away. So years later, I met Heather, the idea co-founder of Divergence, because she was bugging me to look at using the possible collaboration of that dry wireless device to use that for neural feedback. And I've never heard of neural feedback before that point. So that's kind of how we got started and why I'm here, where I am. So, yeah.
And Jay's done a lot of work with your company. How did you get started with these guys? I mean, everybody's using your information. You've been around forever, but how'd you find them?
I've been around forever, I'm not that hard to find. So they had some questions about EEG and specifically DMT effect on EEG. And they had a stack of recordings of people being exposed to both placebo as well as DMT. And I took the opportunity to go through the raw EEG and process it out a little bit so that they could have a crude level, 30 second at a time view of what the spectrum of the EEG was doing under the influence. And during that, we also tried to identify some features within the EEG that might end up being features of concern. And my work previously on EEG endophenotypes ends up being somewhat useful in this respect. We previously had identified in a cluster analysis of a large data set of patients that had failed psychiatric medication, what EEG features predicted the medication failure. And using that information, I hypothesized that there were a couple of EEG endophenotypes that would end up being potentially problematic for use with DMT or psilocybin or any of the dissociatives, ketamine, et cetera. And, not everybody has a pleasant outcome with ketamine. There's the the dreaded K-hole. You can end up having psilocybin trips that have longer standing negative consequences. And psychotic episodes can be triggered with the dissociatives. So being able to predict a little bit ahead of time who needs to be looked at as a potential high-risk exposure client is something that I was trying to help with. I pointed to unexpected epileptiform content. If you don't know that they've got epileptiform content in the EEG, how can you avoid overstimulating them with a medication? And obviously, epileptiform content can end up triggering psychiatric disturbances. A third of all psychotic patients have epileptiform content in their EEG. So it pops up in an unexpected way in clinical groups as well. About 25% of the ADD population, the ADD ADHD population, 60% of the autism, about 12% of the anxiety disorders. Almost half of those with Tourette syndrome. So, you know, we've got a high probable interaction between the EEG, you know, findings that are kind of a warning sign. And if you're just randomly taking in patients for exposure without any kind of a screening, you may end up having kind of a surprise difficulty. The other pattern other than epileptiform content was spindling excess beta, which isn't just some beta in the EEG, it's gigantic beta, bigger than 20 microvolts, hypersinusoidal content. And that's quite commonly seen in bipolar. It's a subset of ADD, ADHD. It's hyperexcitable cortex. And again, tossing things that have a stimulating property in on top of something like that can end up having a negative consequence. So, I can't help but stick my nose in everybody's business, and giving out consults without fees basically brings me into a few different locations to have people listen to my babbling. So. And they didn't shut down the Zoom meeting when I was talking, so it must have gone okay. So
now we had a lot of listener response asking about ketamine and the psychedelics. I'm guessing that in dealing with depression would be a number one symptom that you would look at in dealing with this. When would you use neurofeedback? When would you use ketamine? When would you use psychedelics? Help the new people out there, or don't use them at all.
Well, if Alex has something to say on it, I'll let him go first. But, you know, me, just press start, you know.
Yeah.
Sure. I think, it's a great question, Pete. And there's been a lot of literature from my observation. I will disclaim everything that I'll say with the fact that I'm not a therapist nor a qualified doctor. So what I'm seeing is actually from, you know, kind of a relatively unbiased third party, in terms of someone that makes tools to enhance the connection between the therapist, the clinicians, and the patients. So what we notice is this overarching approach of integrating, psychedelics such as ketamine, psilocybin, and so on with physiological treatment modalities such as neurofeedback. And the reason being predominantly that, psychedelic compounds alone isn't going to by any means guarantee the outcome, especially when it comes to patients not relapsing and increasing overall remission rate. What we often find is well, not we, but the psychedelic research community, I should be very careful around this, is that, with the right set and setting, with the right proper methodology for integrating the benefits obtained during the psychedelic session, you know, that would amplify the longitudinal outcomes. So it'll increase remission, it'll reduce relapse in a longitudinal view, you know, as opposed to sort of naively treating patients with psychedelics without any change of integration in set and setting. So I think that's where neurofeedback really comes in. And Dr. Jeff Tarn has an excellent talk that I can share with all of you in regards to how to integrate, you know, neurofeedback and neuromeditation, particularly, which, you know, something Dr. Tarn is an expert in the world, into ketamine therapy to help people really integrating the benefit of the drug. So I think that's really the focal point of conversation. How do we improve? And the other aspect is, how do we improve the assessment? Because not every drug is suitable for every individual. You know, there's a lot of, you know, Robin Carr Harris talks about this idea of pre-state, state, and post-state. So, and this is really the neurological composition in terms of neural correlates as a foundation of an individual. You know, you really have to have a very decent grasp on this, because otherwise, you know, the consequences can be less than ideal or even tragic. You know, if you treated the patient that's in the wrong state, and you know, all of these can be the domain where, you know, neurophysiology, EEG-based brain mapping assessments, neurofeedback can add immense value in that process. So that's what my uneducated opinion is.
So ketamine is the IV, right?
It can be
given IM. Nasally as well.
Yeah, it can be nasal, can be IM, can be IV.
Okay.
And the injected form basically ends up usually being more potent. The sessions are reportedly a little bit more intense than a nasal. However, the pattern in the brain that you're targeting with the ketamine is, I think, or any of the dissociatives, is, I think, an important aspect of what we're looking at. TMS is a way to treat depression, and it has an established application. And there's a group that patented the use of ketamine or any of the other dissociatives along with TMS, but they don't target just the left frontal spot that the classic DSM-oriented targeting with TMS does. They basically look at the brain and find a thalamocortical dysrhythmia, which is a specific pattern. It's a slowed alpha rhythm that slows down into the theta frequency band, and it's surrounded by gamma. And when you see that pattern, that's the biomarker that they point the TMS magnet at. And they're not looking for a left frontal or right frontal or midline or posterior. When they find that target, that's what the TMS is pointed at. And the ketamine allows the TMS to be done with a higher intensity. I mean, you could do oral surgery on ketamine. So, you know, a little muscle twitch that might be a little uncomfortable or distracting isn't going to be much of a distraction when you're on ketamine. So instead of 80% of the motor threshold, or, you know, find what makes the motor threshold twitch and then turn it down a little bit, they find what makes the motor threshold twitch and turn it up. So it's a much more intense pulse. They report even better outcomes than classic TMS researchers. Now, you have to take into account that this is a group that's patented an approach, and, you know, their data showing their outcome to be superior to everyone else's outcome. Yeah, you know, it's like a drug company funding their own research. You've got to think twice about believing it fully. So I'll hold back on saying it's the best thing since sliced bread, but it's a tempting approach. I worked with a psychiatric group in New York, and I was on the TMS planning clinical TMS Society's planning committee for 5 years, So I have a little bit of experience in it. I actually gave the talk on thalamocortical dysrhythmia targeting with TMS at the last meeting I could attend. It was the highest attended breakout session they'd ever had. We actually ran out of room in the room. I'd say it was standing room only, but they were sitting in the center aisle as well. The fire marshal should have shut us down, you know. But it's a way to pick the medication not based on the DSM subjective complaint, which is, you know, I've got depression, doc, whatever that means to the person. I mean, you can have depression. I'm sad. I'm boohoo. My mood is terrible. You can have depression. I don't have any motivation. I lack initiation. You know, I don't have any get up and go. That's a totally different presentation. You can have an agitated depression or anxiety based depression. Again, a totally different presentation. And it's basically the same problem in a different aspect of the frontal lobe's neural network. And you can see that in the data, independent of listening to the story. You know, you should listen to the story with as much empathy as you can muster, but set that story aside, look at the data, trust the data, because the data doesn't change, the stories do. And at that point, you've got a reliable target. What we found in the psychiatric practice, that if we found theta frequencies at the frontal midline, at that point, we looked at the EEG a second time with independent component analysis. And if that theta and gamma were in the same component, we had a dysrhythmia. And that gave us a target that we could shoot the TMS magnet at, along with ketamine. And they had very good outcomes. They did present their data on a poster at one of the meetings, but, you know, poster sessions, you know, it's heck, half the posters, people, you know, are drinking their wine and they walk by and nod their head and you know, they look at a couple of headlines, and if it's not in their area, they just go to the next poster. So, you know, thalamocortical dysrhythmia and, you know, ketamine aren't exactly TMS, you know, prime areas of concern. So I think the poster was a little undervalued, perhaps. But the use of any of the dissociatives to end up improving brain function is still obviously an emerging area of application, but it appears to be very powerful. If you think of it, the dissociatives and hallucinogens actually increase the neural network connectivity. And some of the disconnection that happens in the frontal lobe disorders ends up being fixed by that added connectivity. You can reconnect disconnected networks. And now once you connect something, you need to end up fostering those connections. If you don't use it, you will lose it. If you fire them together, they were wired together. So if you get an enhanced connectivity during a session, you need to foster that with a therapeutic follow-on, and the guide that helps you go through your session ends up being a critical piece of that experience. And I think that the groups that are working on hallucinogens that are responsible are setting up longer term assessments, getting the set proper, making sure you're paired up with good therapists that can end up helping with any untoward experience and help guide the experience of the individual and help kind of debrief them at the end to consolidate the what's been learned in the session. Obviously, DMT is a quicker, you can do that in a 1 hour scheduled appointment with the doctor. Psilocybin, not so much a 1 hour trip. You've got your day set for that. And they usually want multiple professionals if you're going to be taking a psilocybin trip. It's an all day event, and you can't take a break. So having a tag team ends up helping. So it's expensive, multiple days, multiple therapists. The psilocybin clinics can cost a fair amount, and DMT can bring it down to a single doctor in a single hour in a single session. The DMT appears to be something that is able to be force fit into the clinical model of a 1 hour consulting session. And so there's a lot of move in that area. And Alex has worked with companies that are researching DMT as a commercial product, basically. And I think discussing some of that would end up helping, Alex.
Thank you, Jay. That was a very comprehensive introduction of the pharmacodynamics of how some of these things work. And I really always appreciate listening to you talk about those things. We have, as you said, been working with, Entheon Biomedical, among others, in terms of helping these companies develop a DMT-based response model and prediction model based on evidence that are collected in terms of neural correlates, in terms of subjective outcome surveys. And what we're trying to do is correlate those two aspects together to build some sort of response prediction model, whereby we can look at the responders, for example, compare their subjective measurement scores, like the QID scores or other things, couple that with neural correlate change before and after dosing. So what we're also interested in is what exactly happens to the well-known neural correlates that indicates immersion, during the experience of psychedelics. So, for DMT, what I'm talking about, if you read Timmerman and Roseman and Robin Carr Harris literature from Imperial, is things like alpha disappearance and Lipov-Zev, which is the complexity score increase during experience, and more subtle cues as forward, backward, cortical traveling waves. So these are the things that can't always be obvious in a naive kind of spectral analysis course, but over the entire course of the dosing, if you're looking at EEG as a snapshot, you end up picking some of these things out. So what we're really interested in, and this is the big million-dollar question, is among the responders, can we find enough reproducible correlates, and then we can overlay that with dosing and other integration that the individuals have had, and to come up with some sort of model that will allow us to predict what the responder model would look like, prior or during the treatment, so that we can look at somebody's correlate before they even start the treatment and say, hey, what are the probabilities that you're going to respond to these kind of treatments? Not necessarily always why up front, but we can at least start it from there. And we also could benefit the clinicians that are administrating these dosing using some sort of guidance in terms of pre-processed or post-processed patients' EEG, understanding where exactly they are. So these are the exciting areas of work that we're doing using brainwave analysis tools.
Depression and anxiety, would that be the two main symptoms that we would be looking to address here? And if so, when do people use neurofeedback? When do they use the psychedelics? When do they use the ketamine? There's so many alternatives here. Me being the layman of the group, I mean, I've heard that ketamine is, if you got a really tough case of depression, you go to ketamine. Is that true or not true? What help the poor moms and dads out there like me, Alex?
The way I think about it, and that's a great question, Pete, and I don't know if I'm fully qualified to give that advice, but what I will say is, the way we're taught to understand these things is they're all tools, and, neurofeedback is sort of the workout for your brain. Heather Hargrave and Jeff Herring's always, sort of emphasized this importance of looking at it as a capability or resilience builder, right? So sort of like, the difference between a person that does neurofeedback and a person that doesn't, sort of like the difference between somebody that goes to gym constantly in terms of their muscular health and the resilience versus someone that does very little physical exercise. So it's an ongoing thing that really shows efficacy in terms of building up resilience, whereas ketamine is kind of a power tool. You know, like you said, if you've got validated, you know, sort of major depressive that's treatment resistant, you've tried just about everything else from talk therapy to whatever else, and nothing seems to have you responding, then perhaps, you know, a visit to your therapist to discuss the potential of using ketamine treatment would be a good option to look at. I think, you know, the danger of kind of putting all these tools in the same bucket is, of course, if everybody has a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. I don't think that ketamine is right for everybody who has, you know, all sorts of different reasons for depression. Like Jay said, there are many different depressive profiles, you know, from, you know, felt kind of joyfulness to motivation to, you know, cognitive functions. And there are different lenses to look at depression. So it's really kind of remiss to look at it as, well, all depression can be treated by ketamine. Not true. But I think it's really important to start developing guidelines as to how we discern between, you know, the sort of clinical roots or physiological roots of depression, and really helps us discern and talk about what exactly could be the underlying cause before we go ahead and you know, prescribe. So the one criticism, of course, a lot of people are familiar with in terms of DSM-5 is that it's such a framework that relies on overprescription and overcategorization, very nuanced psychological and neurological phenomena. So, you know, it attempts to sort of bucket everything under a score-based categorization, which is anything but helpful. So, you know, we're trying to do is the exact opposite. We're breaking phenotypes down using, you know, biomarker-based correlates, and combine that with narrative assessments, we can build a much more personalized, much more predictive, sensitive model in terms of how, you know, somebody's progressing in terms of, say, cognitive control or frontal executive function restoration, you know. And so these things lead to, you know, a manifestation of maladjustments such as what we would call depression or a trauma response or anxiety. So, you know, understanding those things are the key, in my opinion, to help us do better in terms of personalized medicine and personalized treatment to these conditions, rather than, you know, basically continue to sustain this one size fits all over prescription based and over categorization based framework.
And I do think we can all agree that depression isn't a serotonin deficit. You know, the classical medical model is basically not accurate. And as tempting as it has been to think of it as a quick solution, it's not. Not everybody responds to an SSRI. In fact, you know, if you look to the literature, it's kind of a con game. I hate to say it, but you have what's called a placebo washout design. Everybody in the study gets a placebo. Whoever responds to the placebo is thrown out of the study. Now, the ones that are left are broken into a placebo group, but they're a non-placebo responding placebo group and the treatment group. And then they can show that the SSRI is stronger than that placebo group. If you look at the people that were washed out of the study, it's a stronger effect than the pharma itself. They threw more people out of the study than responded to the drug. So they've got a kind of a tilted pool table. Everything goes into the corner pocket. They set up the game before they publish the journal. And the journals are in on it. I mean, they get the drug company buys 1,000 copies of the journal and hands it out to doctors' offices, reprints. It's lucrative for the publishers as well. So you end up with a tilted pool table, unfair game level of proof. And the effectiveness is somewhere around 40+%. And I don't run to Vegas with the chances of 40% success. You know, I'm going to come back without as much as I went with, you know? So why would you, why? I mean, it's such a weak predictor. Now, if you have hypercoherent alpha at the anterior cingulate, now, especially if it's slower than 10, substantially slower than 10 hertz, you have an 85% chance of a positive outcome. That's not using the symptom of depression to predict the drug use that's effective. It's looking at a biomarker that makes it effective. If you have OCD and anterior alpha that's slower than 10, you have an 85% positive likelihood of an SSRI working. So, you know, you have to actually look at what's being done clinically and the kind of the tilted pool table of the research that's out there. So if you're depressed, it's a symptom cluster. If you've had depression only for a short period of time, ketamine is probably not your solution. Counseling work, seeing your psychologist or psychiatrist to end up trying some of the pharma approaches that can work. And if you're having multiple negative outcomes at that point, some of the more innovative approaches like ketamine and TMS or their combination end up being something that you can consider. TMS, for instance, the drug companies, depending upon the drug companies, want you to have failed talk therapy and at least two. Some drug companies, there's some insurance companies want three pharma trials and a full trial. Not, I gave it to them, they said they didn't like it and they quit. You got to give it a month or so of try to see whether it's going to be effective. If you can show that you've tried and tried and tried and nothing has worked, then the insurance companies will approve TMS for depression. Ketamine is probably in about the same circumstance. If you've tried a few different ways, ketamine will probably come up as an alternative. It's becoming more and more commonly used. Intranasal ketamine in an office visit is very common. Infusion clinics are a little bit more complex, they're not uncommon at this point either. So, you have to kind of watch if you go to the doctor for the first visit and they recommend ketamine, that's the whole world is nails and it's a hammer. You know, it's that's the one solution they have. Well, that's jumping all the way to, you know, atomic bombs instead of trying something small first. And you should go through the hierarchy of attempts. Neurofeedback as an example, you know, neurofeedback doesn't have serotonin withdrawal syndrome as a potential side effect of trying it. So let's try some of these behavioral approaches before we just jump into pharma sometimes as well.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, these alternatives. What's the hierarchy? I know where it's not a be-all, end-all, hammers and nails. It's you know, ketamine, then TMS, and then I'm trying to figure out psychedelics. That's a new one. Depending if it's legal or not in the area that you're doing it. How does psychedelics come into play? Because that came up last week, and it's the first time that I've heard it. Where does that come in the spectrum of the hierarchy, guys?
It's also like ketamine. It's one of the, you've already tried a whole bunch of other things before you end up getting referred for that. And obviously the local, you know, legal options are a major consideration as well. You don't, as a therapist, want to go to jail because you're trying a therapy on somebody. But, you know, I've got friends in the Netherlands that have been running psilocybin clinics for quite a few years now. So, you know, it depends upon where you are and what's allowed under your local laws. If everybody books a flight to Amsterdam real quick, I can understand what's going on, you know. But there's locations in the U.S. that is psilocybin is legal now, too. So it's not federally, but locally, none of the law enforcement people are going to bust you locally. So it's kind of like some states allow medical or recreational marijuana, and some states you go to jail for the same thing. So you gotta look and see what's going on locally. Even for neurofeedback and stimulation technologies, you can also get in trouble for doing that if you're doing something that's outside of your licensure. In New York, people that were passing electrical currents through the head for therapy were busted for practicing medicine without a license. And they were stopped from using devices that were electrical stimulation of the brain in New York. Other states, you know, it's iffy as to whether one state will allow it or another one won't. Generally, stimulation technologies are generally okay in the U.S. DC stim, AC stim, pulsed EMF, the various kinds of stimulation technologies. And they also help with mood regulation. You know, you can activate a brain area with direct current or AC, you know, alternating current or pulsed EMF. So you don't always have to have a $250,000 magnet to end up influencing the cortex.
Alex, what does a psychedelic visit look like? Because people are asking, I'm like, I don't know.
Well, listen, I mean, it's like Jay said, it's been very much interesting. It's heterogeneous depending on where you are. It's state by state,
right.
And up here, it's a bit more federally driven in Canada. So the Canadian perspective, this is, you know, we're finally starting to have conversation. I think perhaps the pandemic had a lot to do with it. You know, we see the increase of demand of new solutions other than SSRIs, SNRIs, and talk therapy has almost necessitated this conversation across the board in Canada. Our medical regulatory body is, as we speak, approving exception licenses for terminally ill patients to undergo federally licensed psychedelic therapy using either, you know, sort of dopaminergic psychedelic drugs or serotonergic psychedelic drugs, either, you know, 2A disruptors like psilocybin and DMT, or, you know, NMDA receptor antagonizers like ketamine. So, you know, whether you're looking at, giving your patients a dissociative experience or a transcendent experience, or, you know, increasing their neuroentropic score in order to reprogram certain deeply embedded point of view or trauma, you know, there's no debate from a medical point of view at this point that psychedelics are efficacious when it comes to certain kind of rewiring. The bigger conversation is how do we, you know, in the community, at least I'm noticing, responsibly develop psychedelically assisted therapy in terms of pairing the drug with the appropriate assessment, as Jay mentioned, and I can't emphasize this enough. Assessment is such an important starting point, because you don't assess somebody right, rather categorically over prescribing, over diagnosing them. It's not going to end well. It doesn't matter. A drug is a drug. You know, it's like any drug. You know, you should only apply it with caution and apply it with a proper assessment. So the other important aspect, as I was saying, is really the process of integration. How do we develop, you know, appropriate integration process that can be tailored to each patient's background? You know, how does trauma awareness, how does the trauma lens come into play in this circumstance? So, you know, I think a lot of the conversations are very healthy conversations, by the way, are being had
in the psychedelic therapy community to look at this on a broad scale, you know, in terms of decriminalization and in terms of responsible development backed by open science. You know, some leaders in the field would be MAPS in North America and Mind Foundation in Europe, both doing very large amount of studies in terms of, you know, getting scholars from Europe and North America to share data, to share discovery, and to really talk about how do we develop this together openly and transparently, right? So I think that's encouraging. You know, there's always that danger, as I said before, to sort of look at psychedelics as a silver bullet. And it's not a silver bullet, it's a drug. It's like any drug. And, you know, it's only to be used responsibly with a responsible framework of assessment, monitoring. And so I think that needs to be very, very clear.
And appropriate follow-up as well. And that this isn't something where you go into the office and have a visit and end up having no follow up. If there's not follow up to see whether there's ongoing cognitive process changes that are still in flux or not, you can end up having somebody spin out after they've gone home. And a 24-hour follow-up, 72-hour follow-up is very, very common in responsible clinics. In California, you can spend $10,000 at a psilocybin clinic and have assessment for a few days, a treatment, and a follow-up. And again, it's not inexpensive. Well, that model is not going to work on a broad basis. It's fine for the tech executive from San Francisco to cross the bridge over to Marin, and they can afford that $10,000 price without any trouble. But if you're scraping by and you're having depressive suffering, you shouldn't end up having to plunk down 10 grand for your therapy. So working it out with DMT and figuring out responsible ways to drive down the overall expense and at the same time making sure that you've got all the guardrails in place that you need to have. It's not just six hippies going out into the woods finding mushrooms. I mean, this is, you know, this is not the 60s and 70s, where that was pretty much, if you're going to run into psilocybin or peyote or something, it was a unique subset of the individuals. This is actually conservative psychiatry and medical practitioners seeing the value in the outcomes that these drugs can provide. And it's not just being done for the jollies, laying on your back watching leaves go back and forth. I mean, as fun as any of that might have been, we also remember. I can neither confirm nor deny, but we always remember individuals that had difficult outcomes. You know, everybody came back from the woods fine, except for little Joe, who didn't have his head screwed on straight for about 3 weeks afterwards. So we have to set it up so that we can have the guardrails in place, have a safe passage through the experience, and a safe return.
And I'm trying to swim to shore here. I feel like I should have a disguise on because I'm licensed. I have a license to practice psychology and neuropsych. So I don't know what this conversation brings me, but my reference point, I share a office space with a neurologist who does ketamine, and the walls are thin. And so it seems like I'm sitting next to the bowels of hell. Like the people are having really strong, you know, air quotes, crazy reactions. And it's kind of frightening. And if I have a patient in my office, you know, and they hear them howling and you know, screaming in the next room, and they feel like it sounds like they're being tortured, it's pretty kind of frightening for the average Joe to kind of witness these kinds of things.
Yeah.
Much for the
process can end up being rather a wild ride at times. People's emotions and all of that ended up having quite a wild ride, but it's also done better if there's a pre-assessment and guides to end up keeping the guardrails in place so people don't spin off into a K-hole, a ketamine negative experience.
Speaking of negative experiences, we only got a few minutes left. Does anybody want to weigh on Antonio Brown? I've reached out to him a couple of times, no response. Seems to me like gymnastics, tennis, everybody seems to recognize mental health, but when it comes to the National Football League, they can't seem to get their act together. Any thoughts on that, guys?
Yeah. We've got Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles and people that have handled it relatively responsibly. And others have, in a more public way, melted down and kind of spun out from their position. And unfortunately, if you don't set boundaries and hold them, people tend to spin out more readily. And I think that he was coddled a little bit more early on than he may have should have been. But, you know, he's still a wonderful person in some way and needs to be handled well, not shunned or disparaged. I mean, he's obviously got issues, but there's so many theories I've heard. Oh, it's CTE. Oh, it's bipolar disorder. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. We don't know. You know, who's the psychiatrist that's done the evaluation that tells us that it's some psychotic episode or something? You know, we know things didn't go well, but we don't know exactly how. We need to give him support. We need to treat him properly. We don't need to foster any of his difficult behaviors. I mean, this wasn't a one-off first time anybody ever noticed anything with him. I mean, he's got history, again, he needs to be dealt with appropriately, therapeutically, not shunned or such as that.
That's my point. It's not so much Antonio Brown as the league that he's working for, because everything seemed to have happened after he got one heck of a hit, which I'll put on this video, by a linebacker from the Cincinnati Bengals. Ever since he was knocked out, it's been downhill for him. And I don't know why. Maybe they did look at his brain or whatever, but seems to me there's a lot of episodes of these guys acting out after they've gotten a heck of a trauma. And I don't see, at least publicly, what the National Football League or the NCAA is doing to help address the mental issues. Just my two cents. I have no licenses other than a driver's.
And I don't have a driver's license anymore myself. You don't want to be passing me on the left if I'm driving, you know. So, a significant brain injury can end up dramatically changing brain function. The individual may have brain function that's out of their voluntary control. They had their guardrails up before. Their guardrails been torn out by a bad hit. They're out of control in some fashion, and it's not unusual. I've seen blows to the head turn people's personality around, from rational, sensible individuals to wild, impulsive, craziness, the Phineas Gage sort of a personality change. Now, you don't have to have a railroad spike blown up through your head in order to change your personality. A blow to the head will do it without having to have an iron, you know, pass through your frontal lobes.
Yeah.
But they're still, I think, as much as there's concussion protocols out there, I think that they're still a little under evaluated. I think some of the newer technologies that are coming out now, dry sensor caps that can evaluate actual brain activity, as opposed to just, you know, are you seeing stars? How many fingers am I holding up? I mean, you know, follow my finger, look at your pupils. I mean, those are pretty crude tests. You've got to pretty much have a major lesion in order to have pupil asymmetry or lack of responsiveness. Subtleties of brain change are there with head trauma. They're just, I think, under-evaluated. Luckily, the technologies are coming up. If you look at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas right now, there's the Koreans, the iSync Brain, have the iSync Wave, which is a dry sensor 19-channel helmet that you can put on in 10 minutes. It does a full assessment of eyes open and eyes closed, and you get a result back off an AI cloud pointing to what's going on with your brain function. And it's that kind of an assessment that's going to end up replacing some of these crude assessments that are out there now. But the technology just now is existing. The FDA approval on that is still probably 60 days out, maybe 90 days, but it's happening. So you can expect pretty major improvements in how things are treated going forward as technology is replacing more crude assessments that are present now. Luckily, the technologies are affordable enough. It's not like an MRI machine, which is going to cost you an arm and a leg. You know, a few hundred bucks a month gets you an assessment device, and a high school can afford that. So on the sidelines, having your brain assessed with an expert computer at a distance and a brain consultant to tell you whether things are back to normal or not, you can have a baseline and look at changes from the baseline. So you can actually be assessed before the season starts. The ability to assess head traumas is being developed as we speak, and it'll end up improving treatment going forward. Unfortunately, the current circumstance doesn't allow that full kind of assessment, and you can see the result. You know, a few major blows to the head, violent outbursts, domestic abuse, you know, things that follow, it's not a good outcome.
Alex Nee, thank you so much for coming on the show today. CEO, founder, Divergence Neuro. What's the best way for people to check out more of your site, Alex?
Yeah, thank you for having me again. It's been such an honor to share the space with all of you. And the best way to stay current with us is either follow us on social media at Divergence Neuro. So that's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And also, you know, we always post our updates on www.divergenceneuro.com/news. So feel free to follow us on any of those channels. You know, we're releasing something every month that augments our platform in terms of both research and clinical products. So we'll be exciting year. Thanks again for having me, Pete and Jay and Laura. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll have all the links in the podcast notes. And I get 80% of it right, Alex. So check on me tomorrow, okay?
Amazing. Thank you very much. Great stuff.
We thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon business supporters. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery. It has been around for 15 years. Check them out at outrageousbaking.com. Tor Talk wants more people to discover Texas speech at tortalk.se. And Alternative Behavioral Therapy They're a neurofeedback service in Vancouver, Washington. Ask for Joshua M. Great service out there. We'd also like to thank our supporters, EEG and Me, Mara, Sadia M., and Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. Hey, do you have an idea for a topic or a guest? Please email me, Pete@neuronoodle.com, or leave a voicemail in the podcast notes. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And hey, if you really, really, really like us, you can always buy us a coffee on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. We love our Patreon peeps, don't we, Jay?
Absolutely. They get great coverage here.
Oh, cue the music.